Less than 1 week from now, voters will head to the polls to choose the people who will represent their interests in Madison and in Washington. President Biden isn't on the ballot, but the people elected to Congress and to state and local offices will have a major impact on what he can accomplish for the remainder of his first term and on American life over the next few years. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Because this program has been pre-recorded, we are unable to take your calls today. Midterm elections, which happen in the middle of a presidential term, can change the course of action for the entire country, as much of Congress is running. Every 2 years, each seat in the House of Representatives is up for election. Senators serve six-year terms, so only about a third of the seats in the 100-member Senate are up for election. Wisconsin has aligned its election on this schedule, which means our governor, as well as various chief election officials and dozens of state legislators, are on the ballot. Add that to the various ballot initiatives to change state policies on matters such as reproductive rights, marijuana legislation, and more, this election has the power to reshape the state and the country. Election day is November 8th. Many questions loom. Will President Biden have a Democratic-controlled Congress for the remainder of his term? Or will Republicans pick up one or both chambers of Congress, empowering them to block Biden's agenda? Today, we discuss the election ahead with two guests. Joining us is La Follette School professor and director Susan Yackey, who, among other things, spearheaded a policy poll earlier this year. It helps us understand both consensus and divisions in our state, as well as shedding light on the topics that the political parties and candidates ought to be talking about most this year. She worked as a legislative research assistant in the U.S. Senate before beginning her academic training and has performed extensive research in the U.S. public policymaking process, interest group politics, and in a range of related areas. Susan, welcome to Route 51.
I'm so delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Also joining us today is Wisconsin Public Radio Assistant News Director Rob Menser, who has been part of the team overseeing WPR's election coverage leading into the November election. Rob, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. Susan, tell us a little bit about the La Follette policy poll. What is it? And, well, what was your biggest takeaway?
Absolutely. So the La Follette policy poll, we put in the field and received results and we tried to interview 5,000 Wisconsinites. And so that is a huge number. We ended up getting a response rate of about 33%, which is a terrific response rate for political polls these days. I think one of the reasons why we got such a strong response rate, including respondents from 71 of our 72 Wisconsin counties, was that while we were talking about political matters, we were really trying to get at what are the policy issues that Wisconsinites really care about, trying to take the temperature on the issues that are facing our state and really ask the question, what keeps people up at night? And you asked, what are some of those big findings? I think one of the things I'll point out right now is healthcare. I mean, that was a real big finding from our research, is that on both sides of the aisle, and pretty much any way you slice it, healthcare was a big issue for Wisconsinites in our policy poll.
Rob, what are reporters hearing about the issues that Wisconsin voters are most concerned about right now?
So what we see are, there's not much doubt that abortion is a top issue. It's a motivating issue for Democratic voters right now, as well as for some independents. For Republican voters, I think our reporting has found that crime is considered a top issue, and that's consistent with some opinion polling that you see as well. And then, of course, there is inflation and the economy. Now, this shows up in different ways. We have very, very low unemployment in Wisconsin. So, if you think about 10 or 12 years ago, when you talk about the economy in Wisconsin, what you meant was jobs. And right now there are plenty of jobs. There's right. there's availability of work for people who want jobs. The problem is that prices are rising. Inflation has been very, very high. And gas prices, for sure, these are things that are affecting people's experiences, that for people who are, have a tight financial situation, really matter in their daily lives.
You mentioned the abortion issue. This summer, when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, there was a lot of speculation that this would really move the needle for women, for independents, for Democrats, to get them to really turn out at the polls. Susan, now that some months have passed, is this still a motivating factor?
Well, I think we know that for at least on the Democratic side of the aisle, it is. So the Marquette loss school poll that was in the field relatively recently, and it was put forward by Charles Franklin, who's a really fabulous pollster in our state, shows that abortion politics and abortion policy is what is a really motivating issue. It's one of the top issues for the Democrats in their poll. And what that does for turnout, I think, is a big question. So is that going to turn out people that weren't going to vote otherwise? And I think that is really the million-dollar question when we think about some of the congressional races, but in particular the gubernatorial and Senate races here in Wisconsin.
Rob, I want to ask you about this, too, because some political watchers say abortion is absolutely on the ballot this fall, with candidates who disagree very much on reproductive rights. Republicans appear to be winning the battle here, even though the Roe decision was really unpopular. How do you explain that kind of dichotomy there?
So it depends a bit on what you mean by winning the battle. So it certainly is entirely possible, maybe it's even likely, that Republicans can win the big statewide races in Wisconsin. People are complicated. There are a lot of factors that voters are considering right now. But I mean, it is the case that on this issue, Republicans really do seem to be not on the side of public opinion. Wisconsin is unlike similar swing states like Pennsylvania or Michigan, in that we have this abortion ban from the 19th century that went into effect after Roe v. Wade was overturned. And so it's not the case that the abortion access in the state hinges on the coming election. That's an argument that governors in Democratic candidates for governor in Pennsylvania and Michigan can make, that Democratic candidate for governor in Wisconsin cannot. But it is still true that ban, it doesn't allow exceptions for rape and incest. It doesn't allow exceptions for the health of the mother only when life is threatened. It has had profound and dramatic effects on the way that healthcare is practiced in Wisconsin. And like, it's not popular. It's just, I guess the question is, how will voters put that in context of other issues?
Let's talk a little bit about climate change. Susan, there's a lot of talk nationally this year about climate change. How important is that to the average Wisconsin voter? And how does that compare to the national temperature?
Yeah, I mean, great question. And so, you know, this goes really cuts the heart of the Fall School Policy Poll, where we found climate change, especially among Democrats in the survey, to be a really important issue. Most of our respondents in that poll thought it was climate change was a bigger issue at the national level than an issue here in Wisconsin, which is kind of an interesting finding across our poll, across all of the issue areas that we asked about. The topics, Wisconsinites really felt the problem was a bigger deal at the national level than here in the state. Climate change is no different. One of the things I thought was really interesting about climate change in our results is independents ranked it as a pretty large problem. And while Republicans, by and large, were lower in terms of ranking climate change here in Wisconsin as a problem, there was a significant minority of Republican voters who thought it was a major problem. And so that's a kind of an interesting finding here in Wisconsin, that in the future, you could see a world where the state is more active in that space if more and more Republicans start to feel that climate change is a major issue.
Rob, I'm curious what your take is on this, too, because it feels like 10 years ago, there was a lot of climate change denial. There were a lot of questions about whether or not it was real, whether or not it was man-made. Do you feel like reporters are seeing that changing over time?
Well, I mean, I think to some extent the objective situation has changed, right? The weather is different now than it was even 10 years ago. And I think it's like it's observable. We've had a string of the hottest years on record, right, in the last decade. So I do think that public opinion reflects what people see with their eyes, which is these weird weather patterns and floods and thunderstorms in middle of December in Wisconsin and so on. The question becomes what to do about it. And as always, not to be a broken record, but as always, sort of what priority to place on that relative to other issues. If, as Susan says, people see it as it's more of a federal issue, it's not so much of a state issue, maybe it could be a signal that they're not going to really prioritize those policies when they make their decisions on voting in the state level.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, absolutely.
What Rob just said, and that is, I'd love you know, if your readers are, excuse me, your listeners are more interested in thinking about some of the possible solutions on climate change, I would recommend that they jump on the La Follette School of Public Affairs website and Google policy poll. So we actually have this beautiful interactive site with all of the polling data. And there's some questions in our survey where we asked Wisconsinites about potential solutions to climate change issues. And you can take a look and see what some of our Wisconsin polling, what some of the conclusions are around the solutions, if your listeners are interested.
What are some of the biggest differences you see between the what Wisconsin voters think and what matters to the rest of the nation, Susan?
Oh, I mean, that's a great question. You know, one of the things that I'll point out from the start is, you know, the at least on the Dem side of the aisle, the consensus around climate change in our poll, but we don't see really any kind of political ads for either our Senate race or our gubernatorial race on issues of climate. So we really, as Rob was saying earlier, have seen a lot of focus on the economy, inflation, in particular on the Republican side, crime, I'll add to that list. Whereas on the Democratic side of the aisle, a lot on abortion politics. So it's very interesting to see at least what the political elites here in Wisconsin feel is going to turn out their voters. And I would say that climate change and healthcare, which were really big findings, especially healthcare, broadly construed, so not just abortion politics, but broadly construed, was seen by young, old, highly educated, less educated folks, women, men. I mean, those students are a really big issue, both in Wisconsin and at the national level in our La Follette School policy pool. We just don't see that reflected at all in some of the political advertising right now.
Rob, you mentioned inflation, the economy. Inflation is really top of mind right now. How are candidates responding to this? And are you hearing solutions proposed by some of the candidates as the election nears?
The first thing to say is just to reiterate that this is about as concrete of an issue as there is affecting people's lives, right? You go buy, you have to buy groceries, and all of a sudden your household budget looks different for the month, you know? The problem is that there's genuinely not very much that any elected official can do. And there's almost nothing that a state level elected official can do. Like the central bank has levers that it can pull on this, but like the governor of Wisconsin or a state senator has no influence over that. So, you know, it's like the argument in the political sphere is that slowing federal spending could reduce inflation. And there's some truth to that, but it's more like you would have to kind of like go back in time and reduce the size of the first very bipartisan COVID relief bill or something. And that's like, you can't really do that. However, this is, you know, it's that's not to say that this isn't like a serious issue to people's lives. It clearly is. It's just that there's like a little bit of a mismatch in how much people can care about this and what politicians can actually do.
You're listening to Rob Mentzer and Susan Yackey on Route 51, a discussion on the issues resonating most with voters heading into next week's midterm elections. Coming up, we talk about the strategy of major candidates moving forward in the final push for votes. Because this program was pre-recorded, we won't be taking your calls today. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Route 51 on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward. Susan Yackey and Rob Mentzer are our guests today for a discussion on what to expect next week when the midterm elections take place and what is top of mind for voters this year. Because this program has been pre-recorded, we are unable to take your calls today. In a few minutes, I want to ask you both about strategies candidates are using in their final push for votes. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the reliability of polls in general. There's a lot of question about this. Susan, the 2016-2020 polls were way off. It is really hard for many people to put stock in those results. Do we put way too much focus on polling as if they'll predict the outcome of close races?
No, we probably do. I mean, the trick about polling and, you know, and a lot, and now we hear these about, let's think about polling in two different ways. We think about it as the individual poll, that's a kind of a one-off experience where you're taking the temperature of either voters or citizens in a particular state or a unit. And then separately, think about what websites like 538, for instance, do, which is really a concatenation or a combination of, it's a poll of polls, really. So what they do is really track all the polls at the same time. But if there are biases in an individual poll, some of those biases will be sussed out in a poll of polls. So that's one reason why kind of a poll conglomerator like 5theory is a little bit better. But nevertheless, we know that there are some problems with polls. We know that there are some voters that are just harder to get at, some folks that don't want to participate or will simply just say no to telephone polls in particular. And that's the main way in which we do political polling, both here in Wisconsin and across the nation, is through telephone polls. And as we have more and more cell phones, we have more and more folks that are just not willing to answer to pollsters, we're going to have more and more polling inaccuracies. The last thing I think I'll mention is that, the trick about polling, especially in a state like Wisconsin that's so purple, and we're going to be really close in our gubernatorial election, we're going to be really close in our Senate election this year, is that a lot of those polls are correct within the margin of error. So what they're doing is they're guessing what the point estimate is, like who's going to be the winner, and then they're putting a margin of error, oftentimes of 5-6% around that particular winner. And that often in Wisconsin means that you could get them, you could get it right, but still be wrong about the outcome of the election. I think that that's really misunderstood in polling, and I think pollsters need to do a better job conveying that to the public.
So what is an acceptable margin of error, or does it change depending on the number of people polled?
You're exactly right. The margin of error is a statistical calculation based on the number of people that you poll for the poll. So the larger the poll, the smaller the margin of error, right? And one of the tricks with our pollsters today is that we know that some voters are just more likely to answer polls than others. So, for instance, we know that older voters tend to answer polls when younger voters don't. And we think that Democratic voters are slightly more likely to answer than Republican voters in a state like Wisconsin. And so there's a lot of corrections that are taking place in those polls as well. And that just adds to the statistical complexity. With folks not answering the phone, that drives down numbers in terms of the people that are participating in polls, and that increases those margin of errors. It makes those polls less accurate in terms of picking the actual winner.
I read a piece last week from Al Tompkins at the Poynter Institute. That's an organization that focuses on resources for journalists. And Rob, his piece suggested that journalists themselves could be clearer in the way they explain polling results. For example, putting a focus on polling is as if they will predict the outcome of races that are really statistically too close to call. And he's saying he thinks this is a problem because most people, me included, find it pretty hard to accept that we just don't know who's ahead in this race when a stream of polls are constantly released that give us the impression that we really know who's ahead. What are your thoughts on that? Do reporters need to look at this in a fresh way?
Oh, I think reporters have gotten a lot better at reflecting that uncertainty. Without disagreeing with anything that Susan has said or you've said, I'll defend reporting on polls, right? I think the problem is that not so much that like polls don't, pollsters don't communicate this or reporters don't communicate this. It's that people want to know who's going to win. And like, it feels better to have a sense of certainty about what's going to happen, even though that is obviously, as we have seen in recent elections, not a possible thing, but it's like you crave it. So the truth is that polls are used by everyone who works professionally in politics, everybody who's interested in politics, to sort of like understand what is going on. And they're really useful because they protect you against the sort of bubble effect, right? Or they should. Everybody in my bowling league is voting for Ron Johnson, or I don't know anybody who supports Donald Trump, mm-hmm. But like, it's a big country, and like a lot of people do support the other guy. And so polling can give you a feel for what is really going on beyond just like the people that a reporter can talk to in a diner. So I think that's really useful. The problem is, as we've said, It's only useful up to a point. Things can happen that shift people's opinion really, really late in the election, and it doesn't get picked up. Polls take a couple weeks to come out, right? And so you're always looking at the past, and things could have changed, or there's this margin of error issue, or if it turns out that, as it did in 2020, that it's mostly Republicans who are the ones who are declining to answer the polls, then you get a polling error that overestimates Democrats, which is exactly what happened in Wisconsin. Now, an interesting question is this year, could it be that pollsters are overcorrecting for that 2020 polling error, and maybe they are even underestimating younger voters who might be more likely to vote because they're energized about abortion rights or whatever? We have no idea. We do not know. But that's with the right context, if you sort of remind yourself what you don't, you know, the limits of knowledge from polling, I still kind of like them. I still kind of think they're useful.
As useful tools, Susan, what can polling actually tell us about public support on policies that address issues like poverty or climate change or inflation? Are they helpful in that regard?
There are challenges with polls, but I'm with Rob. I mean, if I made it sound like I don't think polls are useful, I disagree.
Well, they're out. It's out there. It's a viewpoint, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why we at LaFollette, at the LaFollette School of Public Affairs, why we did a poll, right? We did a poll in part because we thought that so many of the polls these days are really part of the horse race coverage. They want to know who's up, who's down. And we've already established that in a purple state like Wisconsin, at least at our state level races, those are going to be really pretty tricky to predict accurately, and especially, you know, with such tight candidates. But on the policy side, we can learn a lot from polls. One of the ways that we try to get a better and more representative snapshot of Wisconsinites is that we went back and we did a mail poll. We actually mailed our poll out to many more Wisconsinites, and we also provided some online response options. We try to make it as easy as possible. But getting away from the telephone poll and putting people in people's mailboxes allowed us to make sure that we had a really strong geographical distribution of Wisconsinites. We weren't, you know, for instance, just capturing folks here in Madison or in Milwaukee. We were really getting to some of your listeners in north central Wisconsin and western Wisconsin with that poll. And we did find some really interesting issue areas that people care about. You know, one of the things, for instance, on the Republican side of the aisle was a focus on government regulation, both at the state level and the national level, and a real strong feeling that Republican respondents in our poll think that there's too much government regulation. And that's something, it's a feeling that's not shared very much with independent voters or Democratic voters in the LaFollette School Policy Poll. And we just found that really interesting. I mean, that's actually an area of expertise of mine, and my scholarship is the study of government regulation. And to know that that's such a motivating issue for a huge part of the Wisconsin electorate is meaningful to me, and it helps us in our teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Madison to focus on issues that people care about. It also helps us in our outreach events to be able to kind of paint the picture for what Wisconsinites care about in terms of inflation or abortion or issues like healthcare and government regulation.
Susan, do you get the sense that this year's polling is more accurate than 2020?
Well, I think...
Who's going to win, Susan?
Tell kidding. Us. I'm not answering that one, right? I mean, I think Rob is so right that we could be in a situation where we are overcorrecting for past problems with polls. I think that's a real factor that makes me nervous. I will say that, you know, political pollsters have never been, which I don't include myself as one, right? I'm not a political pollster. I'm a user and observer of polls. And I would say that they've never worked harder to try to get it right, right? I mean, so they know a lot of the problems, at least they know the problems that happened in 2020, and they're aware of them. And the question is, whether they are overcorrecting. I will state that I'm a data analyst. I use statistics in my research and in my teaching and in my outreach. And I will say that I always prefer, you know, to get the descriptive statistics right, you know, to get it right the first time, to be polling the right people and, you know, really be capturing their attitudes without doing a lot of correcting. And so that does make me a bit nervous going in to these 2022 elections.
The polls that I've seen are consistently showing that a majority of people have a negative view of Senator Ron Johnson, but those same polls show he seems to be winning this race. Rob, how do you explain that?
Well, I mean, I think the explanation is political polarization, right? You know, so Ron Johnson, the U.S. senator, he is among a handful of the most right-wing senators in the Senate. And so as a result of that, he has a really strong bond with very conservative voters and this sort of Republican base. He, you know, there was just a New York Times story about how he goes on talk radio, you know, conservative talk radio constantly. And you can see it at rallies for Republicans, like the sort of most active Republicans really love him. But then this is a polarized nation and a polarized state. And so the flip side of that is that he became a very big target for Democrats. And, you know, part of that is he has taken positions on abortion rights, certainly on Social Security and other issues that are there are unpopular positions, unpopular with independents. But it's also the case that so what happened was by the time that the sort of general election rolled around is August this year, voters really had an opinion about Ron Johnson. They had formed an opinion about him as a senator. So the campaign strategy that he ran was to just flood the airwaves with attacks on his Democratic opponent, Mandela Barnes. And like, if the polls are right, as we discussed, it looks like that was an effective strategy for him.
Did Ron Johnson's strategy shift throughout the campaign, or did it largely stay this focused?
I think that what some people might have predicted would have been that he would try to move towards the center this year, right? That's a sort of normal politics move. And, like, he really did not do that. He continued making news throughout this year by taking quite right-wing positions that were unusual in an election year, but it's just a fact that Mandela Barnes, though he is lieutenant governor, a lot of people did not have a formed opinion of him, especially the sort of like not very political independent voters, not very attached, you know, and so the sort of negative campaign strategy, like it works when voters don't have a clear, already have a fully formed view of the other candidate.
Hmm. Susan, do you think we are seeing more voters who support candidates because they don't like the opponent rather than the favorability of the candidates themselves? What do you think?
That is a fascinating question. And, you know, so one of the neat things that the LaFalle School is doing this year is actually in partnership with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Wisconsin Public Radio to put on some events across Wisconsin that we are jointly calling the Main Street Agenda Project. And what we've done in a bunch of locations like Milwaukee, Pilwaukee, Green Bay, and in fact, with Wausau, we are bringing together folks to talk about the election, as well as just average citizens across the political spectrum to kind of get their perspective on the election. And one of the things we've seen from those citizen panels across time is that kind of feeling that, you know, I don't really like anybody in the race. So I'm gonna vote for the lesser of two evils. And so you do see that coming out from kind of ordinary Wisconsin citizens. And I mean ordinary citizens across the political aisle. So we've made a conscious effort of making sure there's Republican voices, independent voices, and Democratic voices on all of those citizen panels.
Let's circle back to Mandela Barnes. Rob, he appears to have been hurt badly by negative advertising that portrays him as being soft on crime, anti-police. Did his campaign shift as a result? And what do you think his strategy is going to be in the final days here?
Yes, I think that so his campaign strategy in these closing weeks of the campaign have been to he has focused on the distinction between him and his opponent on abortion rights. That is, we've said repeatedly, like that's an issue where Democrats believe that they're on the right side of public opinion. And now, I mean, I think in the sort of very, very home stretch of the campaign, it really is like it's a turnout operation. And so that, you know, that's always true at this stage of the campaign. But in Barnes' campaign, you see, you know, he had former President Barack Obama campaigning for him in Milwaukee last weekend. The black vote, Mandela Barnes, who is himself black, in Milwaukee is going to be very, very crucial. And if he could achieve sort of like, you know, Obama levels of African-American voter turnout in Milwaukee, that might make a difference. That might matter in that campaign. So that was aimed at motivating those voters. Just this week, Senator Bernie Sanders was in Wisconsin and did several stops at sort of like college towns, including Madison. And that's a focus on trying to get those younger voters who may be more left-wing out to vote. And so it's really like that's a turnout operation, but those you can see in those surrogate visits some, you know, what the sort of campaign strategy is for Barnes at this stage.
I want to talk a little bit about the crime statistics. Susan, what does your research tell you about the impact of this perceived rise in violent crime? There's incomplete data from the FBI. There were some problems with that data because not all agencies are reporting, but they say violent crime fell by an estimated 1%, but the number of murders increased pretty significantly, 4% nationwide. Milwaukee has a 40% increase in homicides in 2022. It's a huge increase. Does that motivate voters?
Oh, I think it does. I mean, I think, you know, we see that in some of the recent polling results from, you know, the Marquette Law Poll, where crime is the number two issue across their polling. Even on the Dem side of the aisle, gun violence is a really huge consideration for the Democratic voters in their poll. And crime is a top three issue for independents in their poll. So, I mean, whether or not, crime itself is at an all-time high, which I think one of the things we know is that crime statistics have changed pretty dramatically since the mid-1990s, when there were really, really high levels of crime. But more recent increases year in, year out on crime, especially as you identified on homicides, creates, you know, both actual but also a huge perception of crime being an issue. And that certainly has been something that has been talked about extensively in some of the political ads and in some of the campaign rhetoric on Senator Johnson's side.
Rob, what about that? I mean, she mentioned, you know, there are people who are motivated by crime statistics in a different way, that they're worried about gun violence and would like to see more intense gun regulation. But on the other hand, there are voters who are really concerned about this soft on crime aspect. What's more important?
Yeah, so within the city of Milwaukee, there's been a from Milwaukee's elected leaders who are overwhelmingly Democratic, right? There has been a real focus on this. The new mayor of Milwaukee has called the violence in the city his top priority. He's replaced the director of the Office of Violence Prevention there, and so there, you know, it is not really a clean partisan issue in that sense, right? It is a real concern for voters of all sorts. However, the partisan appeal from Senator Johnson and other Republicans, from Tim Michaels running for governor, I think it's probably fair to say that those are aimed not so much at Milwaukee voters, who are largely Democrats, but at shaping the perception of suburban voters, voters outside of Milwaukee entirely, that this place is out of control and that it is the Democrats' fault.
Susan Yackey and Rob Menser are our guests today on Route 51 as we continue our discussion on what to expect in next week's midterm election and what is resonating most with voters. Ahead, we'll hear about the perceived differences between urban and rural voters and why or why not that may play a role on November 8th. Because this program has been pre-recorded, we are unable to take your calls today. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you. Thank you for joining us on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Our guests today are WPR Assistant News Director Rob Mentzer and La Follette School Professor and Director Susan Yackey, who stay with us as we continue our discussion on the upcoming election and what to expect when the final vote tallies are announced. Because this program has been pre-recorded, we are unable to take your calls today. Rob, there's a common perception that urban voters tend to be more blue votes, you know, while rural voters are increasingly red and turning out for Republican candidates. Is that true? What's your sense of that?
Oh, it's true. I mean, I think that, you know, it's been true for quite a long time that that Republicans do better in rural areas. What has happened since 2016 is that Republicans, or, well, not cleanly, but sort of, the trend since 2016 has been that Republicans now just wipe out Democrats in rural areas. And that was very consequential for the presidential elections in 2016 and 2020. That made the very, very close. And it really makes a difference. You can really see the difference. You know, when Tammy Baldwin ran for re-election in 2018, she didn't win rural areas, but she sort of like held her own, and she ended up winning re-election quite comfortably. Whereas other candidates, you know, Hillary Clinton in 2016, who just got crushed in rural Wisconsin, and it makes a difference. You can't win a statewide race with those type of margins.
Susan, what are your thoughts on the differences between urban and rural voters? Are their priorities just different?
Well, I think there's a lot of self-selection and where people end up living these days. And I think that is driving a lot of these issues. And one of the things we haven't been talking about quite as much is the suburbs, right? So I think that is, you know, there's spaces between urban and rural where a lot of the campaigns are orienting their political advertisements around. You know, so I think a lot of the crime appeals, the inflation appeals on the Republican side of the aisle or on the Democratic side of the aisle is thinking about turning out suburban women on the abortion issue is where at least the candidates are placing their bets in terms of turnout in Wisconsin.
The third U.S. congressional district was most recently held by a Democrat, Ron Kind. He's not seeking another term. In fact, it was Democratic for like more than 20 years. But voters in this district appear to have shifted from blue to red, and what appeared to be a competitive race between Democrat Brad Paff and Republican Derek Van Orden really appears to be a likely pickup for Republicans. Why the shift here? Rob, what do you think?
Well, so this was, first, you know, we should say, like, that's according to multiple sort of national political handicappers. This is like now considered a likely Republican seat. And it's not that, you know, that's not shocking information. Trump won the district in 2020. And Derek Van Orden, who ran that year, narrowly lost. So Ron Kind, a longtime incumbent and a moderate Democrat, was able to overperform Donald Trump. So there were like Trump Kind voters, you know. And so when Ron Kind announced that he would not seek re-election, this became a top target for Republicans. And again, it like based on the information that we have, it looks like that's the way it's going to go. And it really is like it's part of this story that Democrats have not really fixed their problems in rural Wisconsin. They got a candidate who is very much in the sort of Ron Kind model in Brad Paff. He's a former Ron Kind staffer. He grew up on a dairy farm. He has been in, you know, an administrator of agriculture policies throughout his career. He really is like comfortable in speaking to rural voters, and it just looks like it just didn't really work. I think it's part of, you know, that race is interesting because it's part of these broader trends of demographic sorting, as Susan said, but where people choose to live, or I don't know, education polarization. Places with fewer college graduates are less amenable to Democrats. But I mean, it looks like it, you know, there aren't signs that trend has reversed in that district.
One thing about Derek Van Orden that I think is interesting is, I mean, he's very different from Ron Kind. I mean, I don't think he could be more different from Ron Kind. But he admits he was outside the Capitol on January 6th. Susan, does that matter to voters in Wisconsin? What are their views on what happened that day and the people who were there?
Yeah, I mean, I can comment a little bit about that, drawing on some of the citizen responses from our Main Street Agenda Project. And we did see, you know, across the political spectrum, and to some degree, these are citizens that are willing to share their views publicly. And, you know, maybe we've got a self-selection there. But many of them were concerned with what happened outside the Capitol on the in Washington. And I think that for some Republicans, Derek Van Orden's participation there is a positive, right? And so we can't, I don't think it's only on one side of the aisle, mm-hmm. or one, it's not just running in one direction. In fact, that may become a bit of a litmus test in some congressional districts as we move forward. And, you know, as conservative as Brad Path may be, and, you know, as kind of middle of the road moderate, that district, Ronkind's district, is just different than it used to be. And there could even be a question as to whether Ronkind, if running again, would win that district now, right? And mm-hmm. so I think that that degree of polarization, the partisanship, and the degree to which partisans on both sides of the aisle are really sticking together independent of candidate is, you know, certainly a trend that's been happening for the last 20 years, but it's not changing at this point. It's still running in that direction toward polarization.
In our listening area here, there's a hotly contested race in the 71st Assembly between Democrat Katrina Shanklin, she's the incumbent, Republican challenger Scott Soik. They're both of Stevens Point. Soik failed to unseat Shanklin during the last midterm election, but it seems very neck and neck right now. Rob, what can you tell us about that race?
So this is historically a sort of Democratic safe seat, and I think the way to understand it is that it's a fairly safe Democratic seat. So so Biden won the district by 7 in 2020. Shanklin won by 11 points against Soik in 2020. So like that's like a pretty comfortable margin, but it's not like some of these safe seats that you see on both sides of the aisle in a gerrymandered state where there it's like a plus 30 or something. And mm-hmm. the incumbent sort of like doesn't even have to bother. It's not like that. In a very, very pronounced Republican wave year, that seat could flip. Now, it doesn't look like that's what we're going to have, but we see that, you know, the Portage County, historically very blue Democratic county, elected a conservative county executive earlier this year, mm-hmm. Very, very narrowly, but like that the conservative candidate won that race. And so you see that that Representative Katrina Shanklin, who's a longtime incumbent and has been a member of Democratic leadership, like she's really working in that mm-hmm. in that campaign, not because it's like she's like super endangered, but because it's close enough that she needs to like she can't just take it easy.
I want to ask you, Susan, about the ballot initiatives and why what they mean. There are a handful of these in communities throughout the state. Dane County and Racine have abortion on the ballot. Some other communities are asking about marijuana legalization, semi-automatic weapons bans. They're all advisory votes, so they don't have the force of law. So, Susan, why do communities include these types of measures if they don't actually do anything?
Yeah, well, this is all about signaling, right? So, and this is a great example of communities trying to get their voice out there, trying to be clear about what the voter opinion, not the citizen opinion, but the voter opinion is in different districts. And I think that that's how I view all these different ballot initiatives as a means to, you know, signal what parts of the state, you know, really care about particular issues, trying to set the agenda for elected officials going forward in this new, you know, 2-year term or 6-year term for our elected representatives, 4-year term if you're the governor, trying to get some of those issues on the agenda in ways that, you know, is clear and robust. I think also when there's more split votes on some of these initiatives, that sends useful political information as well. And so I think the hope for voters is that our elected representatives are going to listen to these non-binding initiatives.
Well, they hope, but do they actually listen? I mean, do they really help persuade lawmakers to make changes?
I haven't looked at the research in this on non-binding initiatives. I mean, there's a very robust literature on in some of the more direct democracy states like California, for instance, where they make a huge amount of their policy through binding citizen initiatives on the through the elections process. And there we see, you know, really very robust, interesting policy shifts that have happened across time based on the swell of both interest group activity in those states that are putting binding initiatives on the ballot, as well as citizen participation in those ballot initiatives, running all the way from property taxes to affirmative action in colleges. I mean, really spanning the spectrum in a state like California. Now, that's not Wisconsin. Wisconsin does not have that tradition with direct democracy initiatives across the state.
Susan's very diplomatic, but I think you can get a clue to how much these matter by looking at the wave of referendums that voters approved favoring marijuana legalization or an end to gerrymandering, and exactly right. No action at the state level on those issues.
Well, I want to shift to the governor's race for a bit here. Republican candidate Tim Michaels has really not been entirely clear on what kind of governor he would be. At least it feels that way. Rob, is that part of his strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, ambiguity is a time-honored political strategy. It's very useful if you're a politician to have people sort of see in you what they want to, right? So, you know, with Tim Michaels, you know, he got Trump's endorsement in the primary. He'll go to rallies and talk about election integrity and getting rid of Zuckerbucks in mm-hmm. Wisconsin. And so if you are a Trump supporter, a conservative Republican, like, he's your guy. But then if you look at he's emphasized in campaign ads, it's his business background, the fact that he has not been in professional politics. And so, you know, if you want to see a sort of moderate, pragmatic guy, that's what you see. And I think it's a useful political strategy. I think there are real questions about what he would do as governor. And, I think any Republican governor in Wisconsin would be under a great deal of pressure to pass the Republican legislative agenda that has not been able to pass under 4 years of Governor Evers. And, you know, Tim Michaels has not given a lot of signals that he would sort of push back against that agenda. It's like quite the opposite. But I do think that politically, it's useful to cultivate questions around all sorts of things.
Susan, what are your thoughts on that? Does that kind of gray area help candidates?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier in the segment when we were talking about Senator Johnson, where, you know, across time, it's become clearer and clearer who what his policy positions are, and his voting record in the Senate really provides, you know, greater and greater information for voters as to how he's going to act. And for some voters, for Senator Johnson, that empowers them. And for some voters, that, you know, creates a really strong dislike, right? And so that record as an incumbent is something that's with him that is not with Tim Michaels, right? So he's able to capitalize on the fact that he has this business background, that he hasn't had extensive experience in elected office, that we can, you know, media folks like you or academics like me can go back and scrutinize that record. And undoubtedly, he's capitalizing on that ambiguity, kind of signaling to some of his voters that, you know, the issues on the hard R side of the aisle are meaningful, while to other types of voters, particularly suburban voters, his business background is something he's really advertising.
Tony Evers vetoed more than 100 bills in his term. They said this is a historic number of vetoed bills. Rob, do people value that? Oh, and what kind of message does it send about what a unified GOP state government would look like in Wisconsin?
Republican leaders have said that they will bring back, I guess, all or many, many of those bills. We don't know if they will, but that is what they said. That the one purpose of passing those bills that they knew that Governor Evers would veto was to, like, make clear what their legislative agenda would be under a Republican governor. You know, if you look at Evers' campaign messages, it's really like a lot of kind of boring stuff, right? It's a fix the roads and funded schools and help small businesses, and this sort of, like, you know, sort of broadly popular kind of moderate accomplishments. But, you know, for people who follow state politics, it's just an objective fact. The Republicans have a lock on legislative control. And a major, you know, what the Democrats what their lever is the ability to control the governor's veto pen. I don't know that people give a lot of sort of credit for a politician who prevented unpopular stuff from happening, and that's why you don't really see that as an Evers campaign message. But that is the reality of politics in Wisconsin for sure.
We have about a minute remaining in our time together, and Susan, I want to ask you about turnout. Polls can really help predict turnout, and of course, it's important for parties to know whether the base is going to show up to vote. What's your sense on voter turnout this year?
Well, you know, I think it's a lot of this is, at least on the statewide election, is really going to depend on Milwaukee turnout, you know, especially the turnout of African Americans in Milwaukee. And I think that if that is, you know, very high, and we are have a chance at some really close state elections. And if that turnout is very low, you know, we could see a Republican sweep the state of for some of those statewide elections.
I want to thank you for being here and sharing your perspective. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much, Susan.
Appreciate it.
Rob, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having us.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending once more a sincere thanks to our guests, Susan Yackey and Rob Mentzer. Our producers are Joy Ratchkramer and Kate Spranger. Ezra Wall is our on-air producer today, and our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at wpr.org/route51. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you join us. Until then, we're heading out of town.